The problem was what happened after I openly resisted a duly enabled officer of the Chicago Police Department. Once he started shooting at me, I'd have to disarm him at the least, and after that it might get really complicated really fast. I preferred to be something other than a wanted fugitive, unless I just killed them both. It was dark. There weren't any street cameras or instant backup. We were playing by old school rules, the winter mantle suggested. Rudolph had crossed a line. It would be too bad about Bradley, who seemed a decent sort, but there were about 8 million reasons around me why the logic came down on the side of eliminating both of them and proceeding to the defense of the city. For all I knew, Rudolph was a Fomor agent trying to take out one of Chicago's heavyweights, well, middleweights. And it wasn't as if the two of them could stop me. Unless Rudolph got lucky with the first shot, and that happens a lot less in real gunfights than you'd think. Kill them, said a quiet, hard voice inside me. I closed my eyes for a second. Maybe I should have run instead of taking the bike. The winter mantle was apparently reacting to the fear in the air, and it sensed a city full of cowering prey to be enjoyed. It paced the length of the cage I'd built for it in my head like a hungry, restless animal. No, I said back to the voice in my thoughts. Killing your way to answers is never as simple as it seems. The best way to survive is to keep it simple. I didn't bother trying to argue about right and wrong. Those are concepts beyond the scope of that kind of magical construct. Assuming that's who I was talking to, instead of, you know, myself. Gulp. I opened my eyes and kept my hands up. Rudolph, man, this is so not the time.
Shut up, he shouted. If your teeth come apart again, I'll shoot.
I gritted my teeth and prepared my shield.
Crap.
If the idiot started shooting, I'd have to take my chances, raise the shield, and run away. There was no way these two could keep pace with me for long. Damn it, I just needed a second or so to get the shield up. I decided to lunge away from Rudolph, over the far side of the bike. In the dark, it might take him a second or two to find me and realign the weapon. I might have time to pull up a shield before he could even start shooting. I heard the faintest scrape of movement in the shadows. I looked beyond Rudolph across the street and saw the gleam of eyeshine in the darkness. One, two, three, four sets of eyes approached through the night, gleaming low to the ground, vanishing into the particularly dark patches. There was a sudden chorus of bubbling, throaty, canine growls that came from the night on every side. Rudolph's eyes went very, very wide, and he took a panicked little step to one side, flicking his eyes left and right.
What was that?
I made mumbling sounds without opening my mouth or moving my jaw, wobbling my hands a little without lowering them.
Oil can,
I said.
Oil can.
God damn it, Dresden, Rudolph screamed. Answer me.
They're wolves, Rudy, I said. Timber wolves. They were in the neighborhood, and they're friends of mine. The growls grew louder. Will and the Alphas had been on the streets a long time. They knew how to survive there, how to fight, how to win, and how to be scary when they needed to be. You ever heard a pack of wolves growling in anger? It's less than restful. Never seen what a wolf's jaw can do to a buffalo bone? I asked. It's impressive. Next to that, human bones are like corn nuts. Rudolph was well armored against reality.
There are no wolves in downtown Chicago, he shrieked. This is a trick.
Technically, you're right, I said. They're werewolves, but it's no trick. Rudolph made a high-pitched sound like a door opening on a frozen hinge. On the ground, Bradley groaned and said, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, what the hell are you doing, Rudolph? You idiot. Rudolph's eyes snapped down to Bradley. That was the opening I needed. I unleashed my will into the shield bracelet on my left wrist, raising it as I murmured, Divinitatis. By the time Rudolph's eyes had come back to me, a glowing quarter dome of translucent force had glittered into existence between us. The distortion of the shield made him a little wider and squatter. The gun in his hand shook. It was a miracle it didn't go off.
God damn it! What is happening?
Rudolph demanded. Bradley came to his feet, looking disoriented and annoyed. The first thing he did was stare, agog, at the glowing light of my shield. He shook his head a little. Then he went to Rudolph and carefully put his hand on the other man's forearm and pushed down. Rudolph tried to shrug him off.
The fuck are you doing?
Saving your stupid career, Bradley said. He kept pushing. The cubic man was stronger than half a dozen Rudolphs. After a brief second of resistance, Rudolph relented and lowered the weapon. He looked up at me and then out at the dark where the growls had not stopped bubbling out of the night. Dresden, call them off. I looked at Bradley and then called into the dark.
Okay, guys, thanks. Think we've got things cleared up.
The growls vanished. There was no sound, but I was pretty sure the alphas had cleared out. The only reason I'd seen them coming in the first place was because they'd shown themselves to me intentionally. Like I said, good people, but even better wolves. Put the piece up, Bradley said, now. Rudolph glared at him, but he did it. I lowered my left arm and relaxed, letting the shield wink out. It left us in gloom that made us all into dark outlines while our eyes struggled to adjust.
I'm writing this up, Bradley, Rudolph said.
Go ahead, Bradley replied, his tone bored. I couldn't see much of him in the dark yet, but I could feel that he was focused on me. I got a pen, too. You just drew on a civilian with no cause.
Whose side are you on? Rudolph hissed.
Dresden has places to be, Bradley said.
What?
Rudolph demanded. Bradley's voice went flat. Don't be stupid. He could have gone through us if he wanted to. You're lucky you're still alive, and your trigger discipline sucks. Rudolph spat an oath and stalked away. I watched the good-looking man leave and then turned to Bradley. I offered him my hand. Thanks, and I'm sorry about that. Bradley shuddered and took a half step back from me, turning his head away. Don't come anywhere near me, he said. He jerked his jaw at my bike. Now, go do what you have to do. Then stay away from me. Like I said, the only mirrors we have are other people. I didn't stare at Bradley's shadowed form in pain for very long. The witching hour was near. The Titan was near. I got on the bike and started pedaling. Chapter 5. I rolled up to Castle Marcone at 12:30. It was an enormous blocky house of stone with a raised tower at each corner. Honest to God, torches burned in ancient sconces on the battlements. Guards in a mix of modern and classical armor manned the walls. Out front of the building, the useless autos had been rolled onto their sides and rearranged into a couple of concentric barriers in front of the entrance to the castle. You had to start at one end of the first barrier, then walk all the way to the other end in an S-line style to get into the castle. All of it under the gaze of the armed Einherjarin on the walls. Messengers were coming and going on the ground, all of them on bicycles, moving by the dozens. Flickers of magical energy were pulsing through the air all around me as well. Spells and wards that were being brought to life. Major league stuff like that took a good long while to spin up. Meanwhile, in the air above the castle, darting winged forms swarmed everywhere. It didn't look intimidating or anything. Standing on either side of the doors to the castle was a tall woman in black leathers and mail. Their hair was buzzed short on the sides and much longer on top. Neither woman was visibly armed, except for particularly hard-looking black fingernails, and their eyes were black all the way through the sclera, gleaming with sinister intelligence. I slowed down as I approached the doors, and the attention of two sets of all-black eyes settled on me like the barrels of guns. "Look who it is," I said. "H&M. How's tricks, kids?" "This side of Mata," said the one on the left. I'll call her H because honestly I couldn't tell them apart. "The Starborn," murmured M. "I still think we should shred him." "That is the most logical course of action," H agreed. Four hands tipped with very nasty-looking talons flexed. These two were Vaterung's personal bodyguards, and they scared me. Anything that could be violent enough to be the last line of defense for freaking One Eye was nothing I wanted to tangle with for fun. Of course, I don't react well to bullies. "Easy there, ladies," I said, "or we'll find out how well you operate at absolute zero." Two heads tilted sharply. "The winter night," M said. "At the weakest portion of the seasonal cycle," H noted. 50% chance he neutralizes one of us before termination. Conflict with the Cytomata results in approximately a 25% reduction in the principal's personal defenses." "Unacceptable," said M. "Unacceptable," agreed H. The pair returned to parade rest, hands and talons behind their backs. Their eyes returned to scanning the surrounding night, ignoring me. "Well, it was nice to see you again, too," I said. "Do you guys like the little seed bells, or would you prefer live mice in your Christmas basket?" That earned me their attention again, and another head tilt. "Levity," said H. "Madness," said M. And then they both blurred toward me. It's hard to explain how fast the movement was. I threw up my hands. I'd gotten them almost to the level of my waist when something hit me and drove me flat to the concrete. There was a high-pitched, cawing shriek, louder than an air horn at close range, and then tearing sounds, snarls, and splatters. I lay there stunned for a second, the wind knocked out of me, unable to get a steady breath in. H, maybe, was crouched over me, her feet on either side of my ribs, the heels of her hands on my sternum. She wasn't looking at me. I followed the direction of her gaze. M was crouched in exactly the same pose as H, only she was hovering over a mess. Her arms were soaked black to the elbow, as was a circle of sidewalk 5 feet across. What was left at the center of the circle was a little more than maybe 50 pounds of tissue and bone. There were some scales involved there, and some limbs with too many joints, but I had no idea what kind of creature had been there a moment before. I looked down at my own body. There was a distinct lack of gore. I finally got a breath. Whatever that creature had been, it had gotten to within 10 feet of my back before H and M had dealt with it. "The hell was that?" I asked. "A scout and assassin," H said. "Swift," said M. "Difficult to see." H nodded and rose away from me. "The enemy prepares..." M rose and offered me a hand up. Her hands dripped with black gore. "Levity, huh?" I said to her. One corner of her mouth quivered. No matter how severe Vaterung's people might be, they're always cheered by the chance to give you a hard time. "Harry," Ramirez said as I got to the bottom of the stairs that led up onto the roof of the castle. "Dios, where have you been?" He paused and said, "What the hell did you get on your hand?" I sighed. "You got some kind of scraper?" He came down the stairway to me on his cane, looked at the knife on my belt, then up at me, and lifted an eyebrow. "Ritually purified," I said. "Don't want to use it until it's time." Ramirez eyed me for a moment before he grunted and produced a gravity knife from his pocket and flicked it open. He was a good-looking man. Dark of complexion and eye, a Spaniard by way of California. He flipped the knife, caught it by the blade, and offered me the handle. You hear what happened? Yeah, I said, and took the knife. I had to go grab some tools. I started trying to scrape the black gunk off my hand. I'm pretty sure it wasn't actually burning, and that was just my imagination, but as it had cooled, it had taken on the consistency and adhesive properties of honey and smelled like offal. My progress was dubious. Just keep the knife, Ramirez said, his expression faintly nauseated. Thanks, I said, and forced myself to keep my tone calm and natural. Where's the old man? Roof, with everyone else, he said. Everyone's rushing to bring in all the help we can. Don't really have many skills in that area. I feel like a fifth wheel. Yeah, well, we'll get our chance once the fighting starts. Ramirez grimaced down at his cane. True. Hey, at least you aren't in a wheelchair. True, he said more brightly. His expression then sobered. Harry, I need to talk to you about something. Always the very best way to set up a conversation for success, I noted dryly. I tried to pay no attention to the way my stomach jumped. Yeah, well, he said. He pulled up on the stair above me so that he could look me more or less in the face, if not in the eye. He regarded me for a moment before he said, Where did you go tonight? My belly tightened even more. I felt everything shutting down, my expression locking into my best poker face. Regret passed over Carlos's face. You can talk to me. What? Harry, he said slowly. You and I are friends, right? We've heard the chimes at midnight more than a few times, I said. He nodded. And seen a few bad places. We have. Well, maybe you should, at some point, consider treating me like a friend. I held myself perfectly still. What? Carlos lowered his voice, but it remained intense nonetheless. I don't mind that you think of me as a little brother, Dresden, but don't think I'm a goddamned idiot. Don't think I can't see what's happening. I stared through him and said nothing. If you're in trouble, he said, if you need help, you can talk to me, man. You should talk to me. Why is that? I said. Because big and goddamn scary things are happening, Carlos said, his voice hard. The knives are coming out, and it's my job to keep them from going into the White Council's back.
Because you are in close alliances with scary creatures who are doing scary things to you, and you barely seem to acknowledge it.
And because you've got access to way too much power, and you could do way too much damage, man. I know you, Dresden. I love you. But too much is at stake right now to let things slide. Is that a threat? I asked him. It came out a lot more gently than it could have. If I can see it, he said, others can too. Talk to me. Let me help you, Harry. I stopped for a second and thought about it. Ramirez was a formidable ally, and good God, it would be nice to have a skilled wizard in my corner. Ramirez was popular among the younger members of the Wardens. If I had his help, I'd have their help as well. But Ramirez was also popular among the establishment. Granted, I wasn't entirely bereft of allies there, but increasingly, as time had gone on, Carlos had come to represent a new ideal for the new generation of wardens, more compassionate than those who had come before, quicker to investigate and slower to conclude, but every bit as dedicated to the laws of magic and the security of the White Council of Wizardry. My friend Carlos would be an enormous amount of help, but Warden Ramirez would be honor-bound to inform the senior council about my relationship to Thomas if I told him the truth. I wasn't even sure that he would be unwise to do so, all things considered. But if that happened, I might as well leave my brother in the fridge. The White Council would never ever leave my relationship with Thomas as a potential handle to be used against them. They would either reverse that pressure preemptively or else remove the handle. The White Council had never been a source of anything but grief to me. Carlos Ramirez was my friend, but Thomas was my brother. I don't know what to tell you, Los, I lied. I was doing liaison stuff for Mab. Liaison stuff, Carlos said. Rumor calls it something else. Hell's bells, Freitas and her stupid illusion. Stars and stones, it's like a British sex comedy around here, I said. Look, there are shenanigans happening between Mab and Lara. I'm moderating things. He gave me an uncertain look. I'd tell you more if I could, I said. But this is internal winter stuff, and honestly, man, we don't have time for this. Ramirez looked away from me and sighed. Damn it, Harry. Hey, I don't like it any more than you do, I said. But I need to talk to the old man. We have work to do. Yeah, he said. He took a slow breath and then nodded once decisively. Yeah, we do. Come on up. We went up the stairs together. Ramirez had a bruise forming on one cheek. There were ligature marks, sharp bruises, forming on his neck where his cloak had hauled him around. Injuries I decided he needed to have right before I'd lied to him. Damn it. I felt awful. Chapter 6.
You look a little green, Hoss, Ebenezer said. The old man was holding down one corner of the castle's roof, along with Martha Liberty, and listens to wind. Martha Liberty was seated in a chalk circle, speaking to about half a dozen poppets, dolls, forms that spirits could animate to communicate with the mortal world, and then reporting in crisp, terse sentences to Warden Yoshimo, who had lurked outside the circle with a notepad and pen. Listens to Wind sat on the corner battlement of the castle, his legs hanging over the edge. He'd taken his sandals off and his feet were swinging idly. Every few moments, some kind of animal would come fluttering or sprinting up to him, mostly small birds and squirrels. They would chitter or tweet, and the old shaman would tilt his head and listen gravely before nodding and speaking in quiet replies and sending the animal messengers off again. Wild Bill lurked at his shoulder, leaning in and tilting his head with a scowl, as if trying to pick up a new language and having only moderate luck. He also wrote down messages. Both wardens would tear off notes and pass them back to Senior Councilman Christos, who was moving back and forth between them and Childs and Riley, each of whom was operating a ham radio.
Ran my boat as hard as I could for a couple of hours, I replied. My stomach didn't care for it.
The old man lowered his voice.
Don't expect me to feel sorry for you, boy. You're a goddamn fool.
Ebenezer didn't care much for the White Court of Vampires. My grandfather had objected to my helping my brother. When I told him that he had another grandson, he had objected to that too. He'd objected loudly enough to sink several boats in the harbor, and the only reason one of them hadn't been the water beetle was that I'd stopped him and gotten away with it. The anger around him was still a crackling cloud of unreleased lightning. But the old man was no fool, and he taught me how to reason when it came to supernatural conflict. He knew the direction of my thoughts and what priorities would help us survive the night. How far can you snare her from, do you think? He asked me. I made an effort not to put my hand on the knife at my side.
The lake shore. If we get her there, she'll be in range.
Ebenezer grimaced.
And that's just close enough for you to make the attempt.
I nodded. From what the island says, it's a standard binding.
Woof, Ebenezer said, breathing out. That changes things.
Why?
Ethnew is a titan, boy, he said. Can you imagine trying to bind Mab? I shuddered. Well, she's an order of magnitude beyond that in power and will, Ebenezer said. You can't just go straight up against a mind like that, not when she's wearing titanic bronze. Why not? The stuff, it affects creation on a fundamental level, he said. As long as it has enough will behind it, the physical world is going to have a very limited effect on her. I squinted at the old man. So as long as she thinks she's invincible, she is? The old man lifted his eyebrows. I've never heard it summed up that way before, but yes, that's accurate enough for our purposes. Denial armor, I muttered. Hell's bells. So how do we get through it? We'll have to soften her up first.
How?
Whole lot of fighting, I reckon, the old man said. Wear her will down. He sucked in a breath through his teeth. Think of it like a bunch of farmers fighting an armored knight, he said. The knight can take plenty of hits from us, but she'll hit just as hard or harder, and none of us can take a hit back. So we have to get her where we can come at her from multiple sides, I said. Pack tactics. One attracts her attention, and another hits her when she isn't looking. And enough hits will wear her down, Ebenezer replied. Of course, the armored knight knows this. She'll play to avoid it if she can, but she has an objective to complete, so she can't afford to stay where it's safe. But if too many of us gather in one place, we'll be juicy targets for the eye. So this is as much a deception as anything else, I said. We've got to get her to commit somewhere hard enough that we can pound her enough to wear down her will. But she'll be expecting that, so it has to be a juicy enough target that she can't resist exposing herself. I shook my head. That's not a good situation for us. We're depending on her to make a mistake. Mab was suddenly there, in her battle gown, a sheath of mail beneath a cloak of flawless white and silver. Her hair spilled down around it like white clouds and silk.
I assume, my knight, she said, that you consulted with your island.
I produced the binding crystal from my pocket and showed her.
Excellent, she said. I do not believe Ethneu is aware of the danger the island could pose to her. She has no concept of professionalism. We can expect more mistakes from her.
Why do you say that? I asked.
She is here, Mab said. She could have chosen any city and accomplished her greater goal, but instead, she is here.
I tilted my head and frowned before I understood. Because you're here, I said. It's personal. Mab's mouth ticked up at one corner.
It is an old score between her people and the she. An old hatred, the hardest kind to resist.
I glanced aside at my grandfather. The old man didn't react.
She must cast down what I have wrought, Mab said. And she seeks to drive away my peers and allies by demonstrating my weakness. Now, on the shortest night of the year, when my power is at its nadir.
I looked over at the other side of the roof where the summer and winter ladies both stood in the center of a swarm of glowing, winged little folk that came streaking in and away in blurs of colored light. Both Molly and Sarissa had their eyes closed and their lips were murmuring. Given the power of her will, I said, I'm not so sure the island is that big a threat. It's still got to be me who shoves her in the bottle. Mab gave me a look that reminded me of why she was the queen of air and darkness, and her eyes were cold and gray as chains.
Any will can be broken.
I shuddered a little on the inside, because I really didn't want Mab to see it. A lot is going to rest on his shoulders, Ebenezer said gruffly. So it'll be critical to keep him out of the fighting until it's time. Mab gave Ebenezer a glance, and what could only have been the most technical sense considered a tiny snort.
If you wished an instrument of careful precision and restraint, she said, you chose the wrong champion Blackstaff.
The old man glowered at the Queen of Air and Darkness and said, "None the less.
When horrors begin to tear apart the people of this city," Mab said calmly, "when its women and children cry out for help, I should find amusement in seeing you attempt to restrain him."
I lifted a hand and said to Mab respectfully, "He's right. If I'm the play, then I've got to be ready when it's time." Mab gave me a look with something in it that was almost like pity, or possibly contempt.
"As if you could restrain yourself any more ably than he could," she shook her head. "Be comforted, my knight. I chose you for times precisely such as these, when an elemental of destruction is what is most needed."
"What?" I said. Mab did something more frightening than most monsters could. She smiled. It was genuine.
"Harry," she said, her voice almost warm. "From the first time I laid eyes upon you, I saw a being who had the potential for true greatness."
She laid a slim, cool hand on my forearm, and pride joined the smile already on her face.
"It is almost time for you to begin to understand it yourself. And once you do, once you understand, we will do great things together."
The old man stepped between us, between the Queen of Air and Darkness and me, and he said in a voice like granite,
"He is not your weapon, Mab."
Mab's smile gained a hungry, wolfish edge.
"He is exactly my weapon," she hissed, "by his own choice, which is more than your people ever gave him. And they call the she wicked and deceitful."
I blinked and shot a glance at Ebenezer. The old man wouldn't meet my eyes. Mab laughed low and amused. She stepped around Ebenezer, running a hand along my shoulder as one might the fender of a car one was particularly proud to possess.
"Do what you can to stay within sight during the battle, my knight, and be what you are. Ethnew will be what she is. She has no other alternative."
She nodded to Ebenezer and said,
"Brit."
There was a harsh buzzing sound that started faintly and grew louder in a rush. I moved without thinking. I swept my right arm out and shoved Mab behind me as my left came up, my will coalescing into a shield aimed primarily at the sky. I barely got the shield together in time for something behind a veil, diving at approximately peregrine falcon speeds, to splatter itself across a good 3-foot radius area of invisible force. Even as I watched, maybe 6 or 7 pounds of meat, mostly, kind of appeared from behind a shattered veil and slid slowly down the sphere-shaped plane of my shield. It landed on the ground with a wet, slapping sound. I stared down at the remnants of the thing. It looked like some kind of mix of a bat, a lizard, and a squid, all rubbery and leathery and gray and pink, like ground beef left out too long. It smelled absolutely foul, as if some kind of venom bladder had been ruptured. Parts of some yellowish mucus were actively dissolving the flesh of the creature as it died, and its tentacles were thrashing, sliming more of the stuff onto the castle's roof, where it sparked and sputtered against the warded stone. I lowered the shield warily and rose from my crouch. What the hell was that? Suddenly, I became acutely aware that the Queen of Air and Darkness was pressed against my back, and I was holding her there with one arm in a fashion that could accurately be described as undignified. I moved my hand hurriedly and glanced back at the monarch of the she. "Are you all right?" Mab met my gaze, her eyes all but glowing. I looked away quickly. Her eyes shifted to Ebenezer, something triumphant in them, and she murmured,
"Yes, well done, my knight."
"I mean, you're immortal, right?" I said. "Why would you need a bodyguard anyway?" She nodded toward the yellowish mucus sputtering on the stones.
Something meant to weaken or incapacitate me for the coming battle, doubtless, she said. Immortality offers a significant advantage, but it is no substitute for intelligence. Remember that, young wizard.
Ebenezer scowled and opened his mouth.
Should it, for some bizarre reason, ever be necessary, Mab said smoothly before he could speak.
I stared back and forth between the pair of them for a second. Yeah, time for things to change. Just as soon as we dealt with Ethneu and the Fomor.
I find Korb's assassins wearying, Mab said calmly.
She narrowed her eyes in thought for a few seconds before nodding firmly.
Very well, Fishman. Have it your way.
She snapped her fingers, and over by Molly, the red cap whipped his head around as if Mab had called his name. The she-warrior, tall and lean and good-looking in that wickedly youthful, long-haired way, the jerk, approached immediately and bowed, sweeping off his Washington Nationals baseball cap.
Loose the Malks, Mab said.
Holy crap. Malks were not so much cats as nightmares that happened to be shaped like cats. Imagine a lynx, only a little taller and thicker, weighing in at about 50 pounds, with human intelligence and a serial killer's bloodlust. Whatever you're imagining, unless you've been up to some damn peculiar things, the real deal is worse. Malks had claws that could shred through stone and some metals, were supernaturally stealthy and approximately as strong as a chimpanzee, and they resented taking orders, even from the Queen of Air and Darkness herself. They might get the job done, but they'd hurt a lot of other people on the way just for kicks. It was in their nature. If Mab turned a pack of those little psychos loose on Chicago, it would be a bloodbath, and they wouldn't care who got slashed to ribbons. Wait, I said. Mab's eyes turned to me like gun turrets. The red cap stared at me with wide eyes and shifted his weight slightly away from me, as if he was getting ready to dive for cover. Even Ebenezer gave me a look that doubted my mental capacity. Please, I said hurriedly. There's a better way. Mab's eyes narrowed. Explain? You're irritated with Korb, and that might have an effect on your judgment, I said. The air grew several degrees colder in the immediate area. Mab didn't move. Save the Malks for something more important, I said. You want these squid wards dealt with? Let me handle it. Till Ethne was put down, Korb can only be a diversion of your resources, right? Mab narrowed her eyes and tilted her head. Then she said, her lips stiff,
from the mouths of babes.
A gesture toward the red cap was apparently enough to convey the order to stand the Malks down, at least for the time being.
For the sake of your health and happiness, my knight, it is an excellent thing that you are necessary to my design. But there will be more of these attacks. See to the matter your way, or I will do so in mine.
Then she stepped back and inclined her head slightly to Ebenezer.
Excuse me. I must coordinate with my sister's forces. Brief him on the plan, if you please.
The old man clenched his jaw, but he gave Mab a respectful nod nonetheless. The Queen of Winter turned away from us as though we were of no more concern and approached a table where Vadarung and one of Mab's highest vassals, a fairy huntsman known as the Earl King, Lord of the Goblins and Master of the Wild Hunt, were poring over a map of Chicago. The Earl King wore his helmet, and its shadow hid his face, but he was taller than human and lean in his hunting leathers and mail. Vadarung looked like an ancient seafaring pirate gone corporate, with his scarred lean face and his roguish black eye patch paired with his excellent double-breasted suit. Both were there to fight.
I swallowed and looked around the roof.
River Shoulders came swarming up the outside of the castle wall and flipped himself onto the roof. The Sasquatch must have weighed 1,000 pounds, but he landed with hardly a thump. His Victorian-era tuxedo had taken a bit of a beating during the climb. His calves had flexed and split the lower legs of his trousers at the seams. The forest person straightened, lifted his shovel-sized hands to carefully straighten the little spectacles he wore across his nose, and nodded down to listen to wind. The old Native American's hair looked a little more rumpled than usual in its long braid. The old man was the most skilled shapeshifter on the White Council, and he'd probably been out and about while I'd run to the island and back. The Sasquatch dropped casually to his haunches near the shaman, and the two began speaking in quiet, earnest tones, while Wild Bill drew back an apprehensive step from River's sheer mass. Even as I watched, a troop of Svartalfs simply melded out of the stones of the castle's roof, carrying tools and poles and spools of wire. They began setting down their burdens, looking up at the sky and muttering darkly as they began measuring out distances on the roof, displacing high nobility and supernatural royalty alike without apology as they worked. And all of them, Mab included, moved when necessary without complaint. Rapidly and efficiently, metal base plates were screwed into the stone of the roof, poles erected, and razor wire strung overhead in a canopy maybe 10 feet high. Ah, the Svartalfs had recognized the danger of Korb's flying assassin creatures and were taking steps to limit their avenues of approach. Sharp bunch, those Svartalfs. No wonder even Mab herself didn't complain. Doesn't matter where you go in the world. If you're good at your job, people who are good enough at theirs to see it will respect you for it. Though it would also seem to be an indicator of how much trouble we were in. "How you doing, Hoss?" Ebenezer asked me in a gentler tone.
I said, and licked my lips. "I'm not sure I've been involved in anything quite this overblown before."
The old man grunted.
"You figured Chichen Itza was a quiet little tea party, I guess."
"Hey, that was just the council and the Red Court." I had to take a step back to let a ghoul walk past me. The thing was half shifted into its feral form and was struggling to fit into mail it must have acquired from Marcone's people. I felt a familiar stab of hatred go through me at the sight of the thing. I set it carefully on the back burner. "This is everybody." Ebenezer snorted out a quick laugh. "Not everybody, boy. Not even close." He looked around the roof and nodded. "But I'll allow, as it's been a while since there was a dust-up quite this big." I couldn't just stand there talking shop with the old man.
"Sir," I blurted, "when this is over, you and I should probably talk about some things."
Ebenezer glanced up at me. His eyes were like granite.
"We got to the end of talking, boy. Remember?"
I glowered at him, and we both kept walking along grumpily, our staves hitting the ground at the same time. We reached the map table, and Vaterung and the Earl King both looked up at us. Vaterung was still wearing his business suit. The Earl King was dressed in hunting leathers from somewhere before the Renaissance, under a suit of dark mail. He wore a hunting sword at his hip, and his usual horned helmet had been set aside. The King of the Goblins, one of Mab's major vassals, he had an asymmetric, scarred face that somehow managed to be roguishly handsome. The past few times I'd seen him, he'd been really big and really scary. Now, he was more like regular human size. He could have passed for a particularly large and graceful professional athlete.
"Ah, the young wolf,"
the Earl King said in a resonant basso as I approached.
"I had not realized he was your pupil, Blackstaff."
The old man nodded to the Earl King.
"Oh, he was mostly a hired hand for a little while. Just had to learn a few things before he went off on his own."
The Earl King tilted his head, frowning.
He wears the amulet of Margaret Le Fay. My mother, I said.
Ebenezer gave me a sharp glance.
The old man didn't believe in giving away information for nothing, at least not between the nations, which was probably going to make that talk with him a little more difficult to arrange and frustrating to attempt. Super. The current master of the wild hunt lifted his eyebrows. He looked back and forth between us before he said,
Margaret's child. Much is explained.
He shook his head wryly.
You've no idea how many headaches your mother caused me in her day. Your visit to my realm makes a great deal more sense now.
Vadarung had never looked up from the map. He cleared his throat and said diffidently,
Gentlemen, to business.
I bellied up to the table and squinted down at the map. It was well illuminated by chemical light sticks holding down its edges. It had been done on heavy yellow vellum in sepia inks, all of it in the style of the old Scandinavian mapmakers, complete with Norse runic letters. And it was moving. Even as I watched, several tiny blue blocks marked with an X glided slowly down streets marked on the map. They stood out against the old-timey artistry as sharply as if they'd been some kind of video game. A tactical map, I noted, of my town. Vadarung glanced up at me with his one eye and then back down.
What of it?
Takes a lot of effort to make a construct like this, I said, and a lot of being in the place you're making the map of.
I've had more time than most to be in more places than most, he said.
Ebenezer thumped a thick finger down on the map.
What does this represent?
Light infantry, Vadarung replied. Mostly what we have available to us. Makon's people are here. The White Court's people are there. The local Fey forces are there.
They were spread out in three defensive positions along Lakeshore Drive so that they'd be able to respond to the enemy wherever they came ashore. Two large blue circles marked the map inland of them, one here atop the castle and the second hovering over the Svartov embassy.
Our reserve positions, Vadarung noted. Heavy response forces have been positioned at each of these points, and they both stand as defensive positions.
You need to mark a couple more defensive emplacements, I said. I pointed them out on the map. There, St. Mary of the Angels.
A church? The Earl King asked skeptically.
The church, I said. At least here in Chicago. There's real faith there. Believe it. If we need to fall back to it, they'll open the doors.
And the second? Vadarung asked.
I put my finger on the map. Michael Carpenter's house. The Knights of Hope and Faith are there, both of them.
Two doughty foes, the Earl King noted,
and armed with fell blades, but only two. There's a dozen guardian angels on duty there at any given time, I said, part of Sir Michael's retirement package.
We will not plan to use them, Vadarung said in a tone of absolute certainty. Not the angels, and not the knights. Not in any way. The being you call Mr. Sunshine would be quite annoyed at the intrusion.
I arched an eyebrow at Vadarung. I was pretty sure I hadn't ever mentioned my nickname for Uriel to him.
Vadarung gave me a very bland look.
We have lunch once a year.
Ah, I said. Well, if some bad guys just happen to walk a little too close, I'm pretty sure they're going to get incinerated. Of course, Mr. Sunshine thinks a lot of the accorded folks are bad guys, too. And I agreed with them, and might have been one of them. I glowered in the direction of the ghouls. But if we need to move people in a direction, we can send them that way and be pretty sure that the frogs are going to be real slow to chase them. Vadarung looked up at me sharply. A small, grim smile hit his face for an instant and was gone.
The frogs?
Fomor, whatever, I said.
I mean, we can stop being diplomatic with these assholes now, right? The other men at the table huffed out low, nervous laughs.
Frogs, Ebenezer agreed.
Frogs, echoed the Earl King. Vatarung's eye gleamed. He shook his head, but muttered something and touched the edge of the map, and blue circles blossomed around both indicated positions.
Our main problem, he noted, is Ethniu. Well, she is not the only problem. So long as she stands, no victory is possible.
She wears titanic bronze, the Earl King said in a tone that suggested he had said it several times in the past couple of hours. I held up a hand. Question from the classroom floor. What is that, exactly?
A unique alloy of Olympian bronze and mordite, Vatarung replied. Kinetic weapons will be of very little use against her. Elemental energies will do little more. It will take a being of divine status to physically penetrate the armor.
Divine status, I said.
Meaning what?
Your knights, perhaps, the Earl King mused. Their power would seem to be of the proper origins.
Those angels you mentioned could do it, Ebenezer said. Mordite is condensed from the darkest, most evil stuff of the outside. Once it's alloyed, instead of devouring life, it devours energy. Heat, force, lightning, what have you, all backed by the will of the being wearing it. Getting through that takes more than simple power.
It has to come from the proper source, Vatarung agreed, and be used for the proper reasons.
Mab glided up to the table.
Sufficiently infernal power could manage the task as well, she murmured. I dare say Nicodemus Arcleone might strike through titanic bronze.
Assuming she just stands there and lets any of those beings attack her, the Earl King pointed out. In the first place, those assets are not under our command. In the second place, she won't. She'll do battle. And most likely killed them.
Vatarung scowled up at the Earl King for a full 5 seconds before he said, You're gloomy.
Merely realistic, the Earl King said.
You're saying that to get to her, we'll need a sponsor, I said. And that basically no one around here is strong enough or on the right frequency enough to sponsor that kind of thing.
Precisely, Mab said.
Gulp.
So we don't have a tool that can break the armor, I said.
Probably not, Ebenezer said. This has to be done the hard way.
Mab nodded.
We must find her if possible, or wait for her to reveal herself if not.
That means we have to react to her, the Earl King objected.
Yes, Mab said. We must be adaptable above all. Then we must confront her and force her to expend power against us.
I said, that's going to hurt, isn't it?
I expect many to die, Mab said. Once we have engaged her, we must grind her down. And when we have weakened her as much as possible, drive her to the water.
Her huge, luminous, green-gray eyes turned up toward me.
Where we must hope that the will of my knight is sufficient to contend with hers.
I swallowed.
Yeah, what happens if I miss?
Mab regarded me steadily.
I should think that the last Titan will laugh and do precisely what she said she would do, destroy this city and anyone who stands in her way.
Whew, boy. So it's all resting on me, I said.
We'll do the heavy lifting for you, Hoss, Ebenezer promised. You just finish the job.
Yes, Map said. Do not fail.
I looked down at the map. In one of those little blue circles, there was a little girl who was probably asleep by now, watched over by knights and angels. And by me. My chest hurt a little, and I carefully packed the feeling away, bottling it, ready to be used later. My
terror for my child would not make me better able to defend her. Storing it up and using it to power spells that would destroy the things trying to hurt her would. Damn right, Harry. Do not fail. First things first, I said. I'm going to need pizza. Chapter 7. Getting pizza wasn't as hard as I thought it would be. There was plenty of frozen stuff in the freezers in Castle Marcone's kitchens to feed hungry Einherjaren, and the gas was still working fine. So, in little less than half an hour, I had several pizzas delivered to the roof. In that time, 20 more assassin squid streaked across the sky. With the razor wire canopy, they couldn't dive straight down, so their runs weren't as fast, but they were determined. One of them went for Childs, and one of Marcone's people dived in the way to intercept. He took a tentacle across the throat and went down screaming. An Einherjar with a medical kit came sprinting, but there was nothing to be done. Marcone's gunmen thrashed and flailed so hard that I could hear the snap and crackle of breaking bone and tearing cartilage. He emitted a single-tone, high-pitched scream that went on and on, growing rougher and rougher, until the venom in the myriad tiny wounds just dissolved the flesh of his throat, and it erupted into a small fountain of gore. And that was the first death of the night. The Red Cap proved handiest for this work. He stood by with a suppressed 9mm, cat-pupiled eyes half-closed, standing in a perfectly relaxed posture, and waited. Rather casually, he brought down 14 of the 20 or so assassin beasts. The last Squidward, before the pizza came up, slammed into Christos's back and clubbed him to the roof. But his suit was at least as heavily enchanted with defenses as my own, and Yoshimo's sword cut the squid in half before it had bounced off Christos and fallen to the floor. He hadn't taken any of the venom, so he would still be in the fight. Once the pizza got there, I had them take it to the far side of the battlements from where the White Council had set up shop. Then I strode over to Molly and tapped her on the shoulder. Molly hadn't changed into male and was still wearing the dive suit she had taken on at the Kraken fight. She sat cross-legged, her back straight, her palms resting on her knees. Winter Fay, pixie-sized but more savage and vicious-looking than my crew, hovered in a cloud around her, darting in and away with messages as she coordinated the movement of troops, I assumed. She turned to look at me and I froze in place for a moment. It took her a couple of seconds to focus on me. Her expression settled in the liquid serenity of deep focus. She spoke, her voice rich and sleepy sensual. "What is it, my knight?" Her eyes had changed. They were a deep, glacial blue-green, and her pupils had changed shape. They had become feline, like most of the she. She blinked several times, focusing on me by degrees, coming up out of the state of concentration she'd been in. And as she did, her eyes changed color again, lightening to their natural sky blue, pupils shifting back to circles. "Give me a second, Harry. I'm tracking about 24 conversations." Then she exhaled, sighed, scratched at the end of her nose, and said, "What can I do you for?" I hooked a thumb at the Red Cap. "Need to borrow him for a few minutes. I'm going to do something about those squid things, and I figure they might object." Molly arched an eyebrow. "You'd trust him?"
"I trust you."
Molly eyed me and then nodded.
"Sure. Go with him, Red. Guard him as you would me."
The Red Cap bowed his head deeply toward Molly and said,
"My lady."
Then he turned to me, smiling diffidently.
"Sir Knight, I am at your disposal."
"If you were," I said, "I would."
"Bold words for a man about to trust me with his life," the Red Cap mused. "Just making it clear where we stand," I said.
The Red Cap smirked. He
reminded me considerably of Thomas, now that I thought about it. 6 feet and a little lean, dark-haired, and beautiful in the alien way of the she that would only have let him blend in to the oddest of crowds. He was pantherine, slim with hard muscle, relaxed and flowing in his movements, and capable of tremendous speed and effortless grace that I'd witnessed nowhere so much as in the she at war. Legend had it that his hat was red because he constantly dipped it in the blood of his victims to keep it nice and bright. He was one of the most prolific killers in the Winter Court, and his star had been in bloody ascendance ever since the death of the last Winter Lady. I stared at him for a second and said, "Considering you were helping Maeve screw up the world the last time I saw you, you've done pretty well in your career path." "Is that what I was doing?" the Red Cap asked, his tone guileless. I stopped and stared at him for a second. Then I said, "Hell's bells." "Ah," the Red Cap said, grinning. "The ape finally works it out. You weren't working for Maeve at all, were you?" "Years late to the party," the Red Cap said. "But I suppose you got there eventually." He tapped his pistol against his leg. "Mab had positioned me in Maeve's court about 30 years before. I'd been feeding her information while I served her daughter. And everything you did to me was meant to assist me. Or keep my cover with Maeve, yes," the Red Cap said. "Or because it was amusing. I'd apologize for the wound, but hurting you at the time was all three. Honestly, we all thought you would realize the script and play along, but you bumbled your way through it more or less, I suppose." I just stared at him for a second. Then I said, "I don't suppose it occurred to anyone to just talk to me. How many feet higher do the letters need to be in order to spell it out for you, wizard?" the Red Cap asked, amused. "Best you learn to read the subtext if you wish to continue in this business. Besides, it's not as if Mab can just hand the Wild Hunt to a mortal to play with." He shook his head. "Strife between queens is a terrible thing for the rest of us. Each can lay commands upon us that we cannot refuse. If one is to hold on to one's loyalties, it requires a great deal of careful negotiation of circumstance and conversation to function at all." "So you were bodyguarding Maeve," I said, "and you more or less betrayed her to her death." "It was necessary." "And now you're bodyguarding Molly." "That is my privilege." "And if it becomes necessary to betray the Winter Lady again?" "I should do so without hesitation," he replied calmly. "If you do," I said, "there will be stories about what happens to you." The Red Cap tilted his head and regarded me quizzically. "I don't think you understand my position, wizard. The lady I now serve meets the highest criteria for my approval that I could reasonably expect from someone still so mortal. She is attentive to her duty, efficient in her execution, and deals appropriately with her enemies. So long as she continues so, she will have my support." "And the moment she weakens?" The Red Cap gave me a small smile that showed sharp canines. "This is the Winter Court. One shudders to think what would happen to her." His smile sharpened slightly. "Or you." I glowered at him. "Just making clear where we stand," he said, in the most annoying way possible. "Honestly, I have no feelings for you personally, either way. Excuse me." And he lifted his gun and sent a bullet about 6 inches past my left ear. By the time I flinched, there was a splattering sound, and one of the squid things flopped and contorted on the floor, coming to a halt and dying a leaking, broken little monstrosity, ichor making the stones of the castle spark and sizzle. I rubbed furiously at my ear, which itched tremendously for no good reason at all, and scowled at the Red Cap. He lifted his pistol, smiled, and said, "As my lady commands, proceed, wizard." I grimaced at him.
Then I trudged over to the battlements where the pizza had been set up and crouched down in the corner, where I'd have cover from assassin squid from a couple of directions at least. The red cap followed, coming to a halt about 10 feet away from me, and simply standing there, gun in hand, waiting. I got down to business. A stick of chalk from my pocket and the pizza were all I really needed. Summonings were pretty straightforward affairs, magically speaking. It was the consequences of summonings that got complicated. For example, I was about to attempt a summoning using a being's true name, right here in front of half of the world. Damn it, I'd have to go nonverbal on this one. It was a low-powered enough spell that, with any luck, wouldn't hurt too much to perform silently. Words and magic go hand in hand. Hell, half the words to describe magic practitioners go back to root sources that basically mean speaker. There's a reason for that. Magic happens mainly in your head, fueled by emotion and shaped by concentration, reason, and raw will. There's an awful lot of juice going through your brain at any given moment while performing real magic, enough to actually do damage to it. Part of what keeps your brain insulated from damage is wrapping the concept of a given spell up in verbalized phonemes, and it's got to be done in a language that you're not really familiar with if it's going to do you any good. It provides a kind of insulation for your mind and thoughts. You can do magic without using words all you like, but it has consequences that begin with twitches and disorientation and eventually result in violent seizures and death. No wizard with an ounce of sense makes a practice of doing his magic silently. But that doesn't mean we can't cheat now and then. The circle trap with the pizza bait was purely pro forma at this point. I'd been working with this particular being too long and too closely to really require it. So, once things were set up, I settled down on my knees, closed my eyes, and created a mental image of myself in my head, positioned just as I was in life and softly chanting a name. I poured a whisper of energy into it and held the image, silently kneeling and waiting. It took less than a long moment. There was a burring sound in the air, and I saw the red cap tense and raise his gun. I held up my palm toward him sharply and gave my head a single firm shake. He stared hard at me for a second before lowering his gun, and then my only actual vassal arrived. Major General Toot Toot Minimus resembled a glowing violet comet more than anything else as he approached in a low, pitched buzz of dragonfly wings. It wasn't until he got closer that the nimbus around him resolved into the shape of an athletic young man crowned with a shock of dandelion silk hair in shades of lavender and violet. He might have cut a very impressive figure if he'd been more than about 30 inches tall. Toot was not dressed properly. I'd grown used to his little outfits made of cast-off doll clothing and repurposed human refuse, which had served him well for weapons and armor over the years, but now Toot Toot had been upgraded. He wore a full suit of gothic plate armor, made of some weird-looking alloy, colored a deep, almost black shade of purple. It came complete with a small black cape, emblazoned with the corporate logo of Pizza Express, a local delivery chain, in gold embroidery, surrounded by letters in the logo, "For the Tsar Lord." Instead of his usual utility blade or exacto knife, he bore in his hands a spear, as long as he was, with a broad head suitable for stabbing or slashing, made from the same metal as his armor. Upon his back, between his wings, was a pair of short blades hanging from a harness, also in the same kind of metal. Toot deftly avoided the clutch of darting pixie messengers and came streaking directly toward me, ignoring the circle completely and coming to a screeching halt in midair in front of the red cap at eye level.
"Avant, scoundrel!"
he piped at the she-warrior. For a pixie, Toot had an absolutely roaring basso of a voice, For everyone else, he sounded like a cute cartoon character.
I saw you giving my lord dirty looks.
The redcap narrowed his eyes and showed his teeth in a lazy smile.
Care, little one. I prefer not to waste a bullet on you when there's so much more interesting game in the offing.
I'd like to see you try it,
huffed Toot, buzzing in a little circle that sent motes of light exploding out from him, like a cartoon figure's cloud of dust.
Even as I watched, there was a flitting shadow, and by the time the sound of the second set of buzzing wings was audible, a slender figure in black fey armor, almost Toot's size, was hovering just behind the red cap, the tip of her little black lance touching the skin at the back of the red cap's neck with delicate precision. The pixie holding the lance was female, pale of skin and dark of hair, and she had way too much makeup around her eyes.
Think carefully, Biggin,
the pixie piped.
For though one day I will end his miserable life, while my durance continues, I will lend my arm to the Major General.
The redcap's eyes shifted behind him. By the time they moved back to Toot, the pixie's distraction was over, and his lance was resting a hair's breadth from the redcap's eye.
Lacuna adores me,
Toot shrilled.
We are comrades in arms,
Lacuna said.
Then I will kill you.
It is love,
Toot insisted.
When you are dead,
Lacuna said,
I get your teeth.
Toot beamed broadly.
See? She loves me for me.
The redcap took a deep breath and said, Boo. Both pixies fluttered back a dozen feet before the sound was done leaving his mouth.
Dresden, the redcap said, a touch plaintively. Major General, I said. Lacuna, stand down. Tonight he is the enemy of my enemy.
Toot gasped and gripped his spear more tightly.
A double enemy.
Lacuna buzzed over to hover near Toot.
No, idiot. It means he is an ally right now.
Toot gripped his lance in both hands, his arms extended to full length, and buzzed in a happy circle.
My girlfriend is so smart.
I am not your girlfriend,
Lacuna said sullenly.
I am a prisoner of war.
Harry, I must say,
Toot Toot said, dropping his voice to a stage soda voice.
That's frozen pizza. What are you doing?
It's symbolic pizza, I said.
Symbolic pizza sucks,
Toot shouted.
None of it is good for you,
Lacuna insisted. Guys, I said, the pizza, all the pizza, is in danger. That got their attention. Toot Toot whirled to face me in horror.
What?
Lacuna's face suffused with joy.
What?
I gave them the kindergarten level, probably cheaply animated, rundown version on who Ethneu was. And now, I concluded, she's coming here to kill all the people.
Uh-huh,
Toot said, nodding, listening, completely supportive. And me, I said.
Uh-huh,
Toot said, brightly, waiting. And all the pizza shops, I said.
Oh, no,
Toot wailed. He buzzed in a vertical circle.
Oh, no, oh, no, oh, no.
That will definitely be better for your teeth,
Lacuna said.
The stars take my teeth, woman,
Toot bellowed. Lacuna gasped, shocked.
This cannot be borne,
Toot trumpeted.
It cannot be endured. We must fight.
He shot out into the open air above the street, spinning as he went. So filled with fury was his tiny form, glowing brighter and brighter.
We must fight,
he called, and his shrill voice rattled from the stones of the castle.
We must fight,
came his tiny roar, echoing down the streets. And something happened that I had not expected. The stars fell on Castle Marcone. One moment, the bustle of the command center was proceeding along. The next, glowing lights, some as tiny as the little elements inside Christmas lights, some as large as beach balls, all began descending from overhead.
emerging from corners and crevices of houses, rising from gardens and bushes and gliding from trees. In moments, the torchlit night, full of shadows and uncertainty, had become filled with an ambient aurora that bathed entire blocks around the little castle in multicolored radiance. They weren't coming by the handful or by the dozen, but by hundreds and thousands, with more gathering from every direction. In a particular circle around Toot Toot, 30 or so of the largest and fiercest of the pixie warriors had gathered, each of them armed and armored like their leader in finely made fey plate, bearing small and wickedly sharp weaponry. The Tsar Lord's guard had turned out for battle, but it was more than that. I realized that I was watching something that I had never seen or even much heard of before. The little folk were mobilizing for war, for pizza. Hell's bells. Well, you always find support for your causes by making them relatable to people where they live, I guess.
Idiots,
Lacuna breathed.
We could just hide and then take all the teeth we wanted from the dead.
You are a highly creepy little person, I said.
Thank you,
Lacuna said gravely. Where'd they get the armor? I asked.
Lady Molly had it and the new weapons delivered with the pizza at the solstice,
she said. I eyed her armor. What happened to all the barbed fish hooks that were welded on yours? She sniffed and gave me a haughty, disgusted look.
The general kept cutting himself because he knew I would be honor-bound to nurse him back to health after it was necessary.
Toot and Lacuna sitting in a tree, I chanted, grinning. K-I-S-S. The tip of Lacuna's lance landed firmly in the space between my two front teeth.
Attempt to complete that enchantment, wizard, she said, and I will ram this lance through your uvula.
I couldn't stop smiling without the blade of the lance cutting my lips. So I stood carefully with my teeth together and my lips lifted away from them and said, okay. There wasn't a visible signal, but Lacuna looped into the air, joining the Tsar Lord's guard, and then, in a coordinated streak of light, all 30 of them came zipping down to the roof of the castle and hit the ground in formation, in unison, in the classic superhero landing, before straightening to slam tiny fists into tiny breastplates, the fey metal ringing like a chorus of wind chimes.
My lord,
Toot shrilled,
your guard stands ready to serve and to lead our people in defense of the pizza.
I looked up and the sky was full of a wheel of tiny lights, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of little folk in an aerial field half a mile across and slowly rotating as if the entire circle, that entire pizza of tiny fey, was deliberately precisely centered above me. The talk and chatter died away as light bathed the grim, dark little castle. Silence spread across the rooftop. I looked down to see Mab and the ladies regarding me with small, knowing smiles. Everyone else, from ghouls to White Council to Svartalfs to Sasquatch